This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon, and can I bid you a very warm welcome to the National Museum of Australia. I'm Peter Stanley, now of the University of New South Wales, Canberra, but until last February, I headed the museum's research centre, and it was my very great pleasure to lend a small helping hand to the exhibition 1913 Glorious Days, which I hope you've all seen. Before we embark on the today's presentation, can I acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet and pay our respects to elders past and present. Now, this will be a three-cornered conversation between me and this gentleman, whom I'll introduce in a second, and yourselves. So David and I will talk for a while, we'll show you some pictures, we'll talk for a bit more, and then we'll open it up for discussion. And I'm pretty sure, looking around the room, that I recognise people who know a lot more about the Navy than me. And I wasn't looking at you, Louise. So I'm looking forward to a very interesting question session, and question session in two ways. One is the question session that David and I will have, and then the session we'll all have a bit later on. Now, can I first of all introduce the man standing to my right? This is Dr. David Stevens, who is of the RAN Sea Power Centre over in Fishwick. And David's been a naval officer since he was about 15, and has been a serving naval officer for 20 years, still a member of the RAN Reserve, and has been the RAN's historian since 1984. He's published or edited about a dozen books, including U-Boat Far From Home, which was an extraordinary story of a German U-boat that cruised through Australian waters late in the Second World War, which hardly anybody knew about until David wrote his book. But his main works have been that in 2001, David published the Centenary of Federation History of the Royal Australian Navy, a very significant volume which sits on my shelves. And late next year, Oxford University Press will be publishing David's Centenary of the Great War, History of the Royal Australian Navy in the Great War, although I don't think that's its title, is it?
No, not quite.
It's probably got something a lot more complicated. So you'll see that David is an expert, and you'll see in the course of today's presentation that I am not. However, I've got the microphone, and I'm going to ask the questions. So please, David, sit down. Now, I'm standing up still because I'm going to declaim some poetry. And if you declaim poetry, you have to stand up. It's axiomatic. And the poem I'm going to declaim is called Our Fleet. And it was written by an extraordinary woman, a woman called Zora Cross, or Zora Smith was her maiden name, and she published it in 1913. Now, I know about Zora Cross because she was a Smith and became a Cross. And I wrote a book called Digger Smith and Australia's Great War a couple of years ago, and Zora Smith was one of the Australian poets whose work I drew on in understanding Australia and the Great War. And Zora's a really remarkable woman. She was, I think, a Sydney woman, but she's most remarkable because she became a bit of a bohemian and had the distinction of leaving her husband and living in sin with a man not her husband for many years, and maintaining herself as a freelance writer and poet in Sydney for many years, from about the 1910s to the 1940s, I think. Anyway, this poem, which I'm about to read a bit of to you, is not what you would expect from a Sydney bohemian free-living woman in 1913. And I'll just read you two verses, and you'll see why I'm only reading two verses, because it's a bit full on, frankly. Here it goes. Yo-ho, yo-ho, through Sydney town, the ringing echoes go of Britain's glorious days of old. Yo-ho, a highly-ho. There's a lot of highly-hoing in this poem. That's why I'm not reading you the rest. It continues for another dozen verses, but here's another one of them. To Norsemen fierce and Britain bold, Australia owes her race, the race that young and free and strong will future dangers face. So you can see that 1913, this Sydney bohemian woman is getting very excited about our fleet. And David and I are about to get very excited about our fleet as well. And we'll talk about the arrival of the Royal Australian Navy's fleet unit in Sydney in October 1913 and all that that would entail, including, as Zora Smith says, future dangers face. So with that poetical introduction, can I start discussing... Oh, can I tell you, too, to remind you to turn off your mobile phones and tell you that the toilets are outside and to the right. That's broken the atmosphere, hasn't it? So, there we go. That's the Zora Smith poem. Oh, there's one more thing I need to introduce before we engage in our conversation, and that is that the title of today's talk session, Gone to Navy, might perplex and bemuse you, unless you know the works of Patsy Adams Smith very well. You might recall that Patsy Adams-Smith, who wrote those wonderful evocations of life in 20th century Australia, you know, Hear the Train Blow and the one about the ships off Tasmania, I've forgotten the titles, and she also wrote that book, The Anzacs. And in The Anzacs, which mostly dealt with men in khaki, she talked about her father. And her father's name was Albert, and he came from a little town in Gippsland. And in 1913, when he himself was about 15 or 16, he read in the paper that the Royal Australian Navy, which had just acquired all these new warships, wanted sailors. And Albert Smith went and joined the Navy. And Patsy Adams-Smith describes how, when she was growing up, she found in a drawer, I think in her grandmother's place, a cricket ball. And this cricket ball had had attached to it a label. And the label had been written by her father in 1913. And the label said, "Gone to Navy." And it's a symbol of how Albert Smith leaves behind his childhood in Gippsland and goes off to the Royal Australian Navy and serves right through the First World War. And I thought, as soon as I read that, I thought, oh, wouldn't that be a wonderful object to display in the 1913 exhibition? Well, we got in touch with Patsy Adams-Smith's lawyers, because she's dead now, sadly, but the lawyers who are running her estate. And it looks as if the cricket ball has disappeared. So we weren't able to use the cricket ball in the exhibition, but I've used the anecdote several times, and I think it's a wonderful label to attach to this session. And now, having done all of the things that I'm supposed to have been done, I'd like to sit down and take it easy for a while and ask David Stevens to talk about Australia's naval defence before the arrival of the first fleet unit. What did Australia's Navy comprise before we got this brand new fleet in 1913?
Thank you, Peter.
At last.
Yeah, well, it depends how far back you want to go, but obviously, ever since Captain Cook had turned up, and then the first fleet had arrived in 1788, the Royal Navy had been intimately involved in Australia, both settling it and governing it. I think the first five governors were Royal Naval Officers of Australia. And certainly as the colony built up, and particularly in an economic sense, and started, Australia started producing gold and shipping it overseas, the realisation came that this was something that needed to be protected. And certainly the citizens of New South Wales, Victoria, were always wanting protection for their money that was going overseas. And so in the mid-19th century, the British made gave Australia a status as a station, the Australian station, with an admiral or commodore in charge. And that was basically the format for the last half of the 19th century, whereby Australia was relying on the British for their protection at sea. The problem with that is that people don't necessarily understand how navies work, and certainly the colonies or the cities didn't quite understand that you didn't need to see the ships in harbour to think they were doing something. And there was this constant push saying, well, we never see them, so how are we being protected?
And so that's, are we paying for them too, isn't there?
Well, we're not paying for them yet. This is the British, right. Other than sort of generally through the fact that we're supporting the empire.
Yep.
And the colonies started to develop their own naval forces for their own self-protection, and that's why you see things like the Monitor Cerberus in Victoria and the Gunboat Protector in South Australia and Queensland. And in fact, you ended up with several navies in Australia, all belonging to the colonies. And of course, the problem there is that people don't realise how expensive navies are. And although it was very exciting at the first when they got these one or two ships, they then discovered they couldn't support them. And so they tended to go up and down in how much effort was put into them. And certainly places like Tasmania, for example, had one torpedo boat, which for a while, Western Australia never really got into it. But the Victorian Navy was actually quite strong at one stage. But even so, they never really put the effort in to keep it going. And so by the time you get to Federation, the Australian navies are actually quite weak. But you do still have the British squadron, which is providing that protection, mostly based out of Sydney. And so you are relying on the Royal Navy for the protection of our trade and for our coastal, most of our coast. The Australian navies are doing their little bit, but not going very far. Basically, they're remaining with their own state waters, mostly in their own harbour waters. And then you see people like Captain Creswell appear on the scene, and presumably everyone here has heard of Captain William Creswell, who was started off as in the Royal Navy, came out to he was involved in the anti-slave trade, etc., and then came out to Australia in the 1880s and tried to start up a business, or tried to be as a pastoralist, failed dismally, and was eventually attracted to join the South Australian Navy, where he rose to become the Commandant of the South Australian Navy, but he also subsequently became the Commandant of the Queensland Navy and eventually the Director of the entire navies in Australia.
And it's his vision for a Royal Australian Navy.
He is certainly one of the people. Uh-huh. There is this constant push to have an Australian Navy. It's not just Creswell, but Creswell is certainly there. He's the one writing. He's probably the most well-known Australian navalist. And certainly after Federation, when he's looking and Creswell is saying things like, well, we've got a trade that's larger than Spain or Portugal, and we can't protect it. We're relying completely on the British Navy. And the problem there is that the Royal Navy might be heading off to do something else. Mm. There's no guarantee it will be staying in Australia. And you end up with a very complicated system where the Australians agree to help part fund an Australian squadron an auxiliary squadron as part of the Australian squadron, which is there for Australia's defence while the real Australian squadron can go off and do things. And I said it gets very complicated. But again, no one is quite happy that this will always be the case. And so we start to develop to this idea that we really need to have our own. And that's where we start to get to 1909 in the Imperial Conference.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back a bit from 1909, though. The situation at Federation is that these little colonial naval forces are brought together as the Commonwealth Naval Forces, and they're a collection, a very, very disparate collection of mostly obsolete vessels, with the auxiliary squadron, which are more modern, but not the most modern. So the early 20th century, the early years of the 20th century, Australia neither has a fully operational navy nor a very satisfactory coastal defence force. So what's happening in the early years of Federation? Is Creswell still around and mobilising this vision?
Creswell is certainly still around. And although we say they weren't terribly effective, it depends what you're looking at and what you're expecting them to do. And, for example, when the Boxer Rebellion in China in 1900, the several ships from British ships from the Australian squadron are sent over to China. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Protector, which is one of the South Australian warships, is sent over to China.
The only South Australian warship,
yes. So it can raid. And then there's naval brigades of people from New South Wales and Victoria. So they were doing things. It was actually, we were actually going overseas and doing a naval job of going overseas taking part in operation. Certainly when Creswell was made the Director of Naval Forces in 1904, he tries to bring a real improvement to what's going on, and he actually starts having Easter manoeuvres in Port Phillip Bay where, you actually get more than one ship out at once doing torpedo attacks and torpedo defence and things like that. Mm-hmm. And the Monitor Cerberus is actually there as a floating gun platform. Mm. So there is this move to do things, but at the same time there's a realisation that that's great for Port Phillip Bay, it's not much good outside. Mm. You can't do much off the coast.
Well, let's turn our attention to off the coast, because one of the things that changes in the early 20th century is Australia's perceptions of Japan. I mean, the world seems a much more threatening place to Australia after 1901 than it seemed before. We often talk about the imaginary threat from Russia. Everyone brings up the Russians and points to the building of forts. But for Australians after 1901, they seem to be much more apprehensive, not about an imaginary threat, but a threat which turns out not to happen, but a threat that they take very seriously. So what are the minds of both federal politicians and senior naval officers in Australia and in Britain? How are they looking at the world in this early federal period?
What they're really, depending on who you're talking to and who's writing, and particularly whether you're talking about a military person or a naval person, it can give you quite different answers. Mm. And yes, Japan was obviously seen as a threat, particularly after the Battle of Tsushima in 1905, where they'd beaten the Russians. But if you look at Creswell's writings, he actually talks about a larger threat. And we'll put threat in inverted commas at the moment, but not just the Japanese, but the Chinese are regarded as a threat. Mm-hmm. And this all has to do with Australia being a white nation and being worried about the millions of Asiatics in the north. Mm. But at the same time, they're worried about the Americans, because the Americans are not allied with the UK. And of course, sorry, I just forgot there, is that Britain and Japan were allies. Mm. And in theory, that meant that Australia didn't have to be fearful of Japan in political terms, notwithstanding more general terms.
Well, that's right. There are novels in that period that posit that Britain's friendship with Japan means that if it comes to a conflict between Japan and Australia, Britain throws its money in with Japan and abandons Australia. So there's all sorts of fears that hadn't happened before.
So you had not just Japan, you had China, you had America, you had the Dutch, you had the Germans. Basically, we're happy with the French by about 1902 or so. So there's these different powers, and you have Prime Minister, I think it was Deakin, who at one stage, Prime Minister Deakin, who says, you know, we're within range of six different nations, of the naval forces of six different nations, and therefore we need to do something about that. And what they're talking about there is not an invasion force, right? We're not talking about hundreds of ships coming over and landing troops. We're talking about one or two raiding cruisers, dashing about the oceans, destroying Australian trade. And this is what Creswell is really worried about, because what he's saying is that, you know, trade is the lifeblood of the nation. If a raider turns up, all your shore batteries and soldiers aren't going to do you no good at all. But what you do need is to protect your trade. If you don't have ships that can do that, your trade is going to have to hide in port. Your economy shuts down, the nation basically collapses. So Creswell is pushing this idea that we need to be able to protect our own trade on the Australia Station, i.e. we need to be able to make sure that we can get our goods even interstate. Because remember, Australia at this period doesn't have a road system, doesn't have a common rail system. Most of the trade between the states is done by sea. In fact, it's interesting that people talk about, Australia might have been so many islands, with Sydney and Melbourne, etc., because that's how they're connected. They're connected by sea. So this is what people like Creswell are worried about. Now, the political side of things, depending on which party, which person, they're saying, well, we don't need to worry about it because the British are going to be here, or we do need to worry about it because we can't trust the British to be able to provide that protection. And by the way, they're not putting the money into the Australian squadron like they used to, and therefore we're at risk.
And this is all a lot of factors going on. The background of this is that there's acceleration in the development of warships, so that ships are new types of ships are being developed.
Certainly, when you the push at the end of the 19th century, you are getting steam powered warships which can range all the way over the ocean. The main problem there is that they're limited by their fuel capacity, which is coal, and obviously coal is difficult to. You need to have set up, the British had set up coaling base stations all around the world so they could get their coal. And although, Deakin might say these raiders can come and get us, you then had to think about, well, where are they going to get the coal from? Now, we might get into a bit later, but the Germans had plans, for example, to actually go into Australia's ports and steal the coal. So that's how they were planning to do it. There was a lot of interrelating factors there.
Do you want to talk for a minute about the... conscious I can't see half the audience. Do you want to talk for a minute about the Americans? Because the arrival of the Great White Fleet seems to have been a galvanising moment for navalists.
Yeah, I mean, 1908, the Great White Fleet, Teddy Roosevelt's Great White Fleet, we had a bit of a centenary for it a few years ago, in 2008, strange enough. What it was, 16 white painted battleships, strange enough, that the Americans, or Teddy Roosevelt in particular, sent around the world to show that America was a world power. It was very much a statement, we have arrived on the world scene and this is how we're doing it. Now, I talked about coal. The only reason the Americans could do that was because they used British colliers. But they did get to Australia. In fact, the Australians invited them, which was quite unusual at that time.
Without going through the
Secretary for Colonies. And these ships visited New Zealand, they visited Melbourne, they visited Sydney, they visited Albany. And that was really exciting for the population. If you see some of the, there's a few paintings in the National Maritime Museum of the ships arriving, you know, lots of people out looking, watching them out. It was very exciting. If thousands of postcards produced. I think Pitt Street was turned into American Avenue or something for the day, that sort of thing, which was really good. But one of the interesting things we've got in our office is the American war plans for invading Sydney or Melbourne or Albany or Wellington after they'd been. Because the thing about warships is they're, you know, great grey diplomats, or these ones were white diplomats, but they're also there for intelligence gathering. And strange enough, we talked about the Japanese, the Anglo-Japanese alliance. Well, if Japan had gone to war against America, then Britain was going to be on Japan's side, Australia would be on Britain's side, and guess who the Americans were going to take out in the Pacific? Basically the Australians. So it was great on one side, great to have the Americans, but at the same time, you know, a nation's interests are only as good as, you know, yesterday.
Indeed. Can we look at the political background to this? The as I understand it, see, I'm not an expert, he is. The navalists are urging that Australia needs to get serious about modern naval defence that can do, as you say, not just protect harbours but can protect sea lanes and the commerce that Australia depends on. But navies are very expensive. And the British, the Admiralty is saying, no, 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 let's leave the Australians as a local defence, a coastal defence force. We don't need them to have a proper navy. And that seems to persist until about 1999 or something, and all of a sudden it switches. And I must say I'm quite perplexed as to why is it that the British attitude undergoes this dramatic change?
Yeah, it's probably not quite as dramatic as you think. And the problem for the British is that for having the colonies to have their own navies is very dangerous, because you do not want a colonial ship to go out and attack another nation's merchantman, for example, because the other nation is going to say, well, that's the British doing that, not New South Wales. So it could be very embarrassing. So they did not want the colonies to do that. So you see that right up until the early part of the 20th century, where the admiralties are saying, no, the seas are one, we want one navy, the Imperial Navy, we'll run it. You just give us the money. Which, you know, is there is an argument for that. The problem for the Royal Navy, however, is that, like everyone else, there's limited resources. They don't have enough money. And particularly, as we said before, with technology changing, it means that ships are basically going obsolete as soon as they come off the stocks and hit the water. And you have to keep building new ships with new technology. And you may have heard of HMS Dreadnought in 1906, Admiral Jackie Fisher, which was where the name Dreadnought came from. And once that was built, suddenly everyone is talking about dreadnoughts. Now, these things are really, really expensive. We're talking about a large turbine-powered, all-big-gun ship, very powerful, very fast, very well-armoured. And you have one of, and once the British had built that, the Germans want to have one to counter all these, you know, the French do, even the Brazilians do, you name it. And, of course, the Americans. So you get a naval arms race in a manner. And the problem is that this is really, really expensive. And the Royal Navy cannot afford to provide the latest up-to-date technology all over the world. And what that means is they put the latest up-to-date technology where they think it's most important. And strange enough, that's the North Sea, because that's where the greatest threat is, the Germans. Because, as I said, the French are okay by now. So that's where the Royal Navy is concentrating its forces. It doesn't mean they give up on the colonies, but it means they put other sorts of ships there. Now, the way Admiral Fisher thinks about this is we need to have fast, really fast, heavily gunned ships that can be vectored where they needed to be vectored. And strange enough, he comes up with something called, originally called an armoured cruiser, which then becomes a battle cruiser, which we'll get onto a bit later. And he thinks this would be fantastic to defend the colonies, or the dominions as they're becoming. So what are the Brits are changing their attitude because of the fact that they cannot keep drawing on the treasury for everything they need like they had before. They want to spread the load. How best to spread the load? They're starting to think about letting the colonies have their own navies. And this is tied in at the same time where the Australians are starting to think we want our own navy. Mm-hmm. So it all comes together. Mm. So it's about 1907 that the Brits actually start to say, well, actually, you could help us by providing small ships. And that's what they start off with. It's too much for us to send small ships from England to Australia. Therefore, if you built small ships like destroyers, you can help us that way. And that's why in early 1909, Australia decides to build some small destroyers. And originally, that's what our navy was going to be. We're going to have a destroyer navy, a flotilla of destroyers that can whiz around the coast defending our trade. Mm-hmm. We then have the dreadnought scare of 1909, where as I said, the British have started building the dreadnoughts. The Germans are saying, we'll build dreadnoughts too. And suddenly the British advantage in naval power that they'd had previously has been disappearing, because when you start with a new revolutionary weapon system, you've got one, someone else builds one, the huge number you'd built before all out of date, you've lost your advantage. So in 1909, there's this what they call the dreadnought scare, where the British are saying in Parliament, we're a bit worried, we need money to build 8 battleships. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a real worry for the politicians in Australia, because they're suddenly being told in public or in the newspapers that Britain can't defend them. You know, we're starting to lose our maritime supremacy. And Australia, the federal government, offers a dreadnought. We'll pay for one for the Royal Navy. The New South Wales government offers a dreadnought. The Victorians offer a dreadnought. The New Zealanders offer a dreadnought. And so there's all these different areas, including Canada, obviously, are all saying, well, we'll help provide you with a dreadnought to build up the British Navy. And in 1909, the Brits say, right, let's have a conference, imperial conference, where we can discuss it. And that's where we get the start of the Australian Navy.
Okay. And that's a good point to go to the pictures. Now, I tell you what, if you stand over there, David, and I'll stand over here and give everybody a good look at the screen, what I've done is, and here's where I have to own up to something, we actually obtained from the RANC Power Centre a whole series of really wonderful images for the exhibition. And some idiot forgot to put them in the exhibition. So I'm going to use the images that the Sea Power Centre provided today. So we'll get a bit of consolation from them. What am I supposed to point out?
Down.
Point down? Down. Down. Ah, down. Thank you. Well done. David.
Right.
Saturday, the 4th of October, 1913, Sydney Harbour.
We'll just walk back from that a little bit, mm-hmm. and the 1909 conference, mm-hmm. and Admiral Fisher. And Admiral Fisher says to the Australian delegation, which includes Admiral Creswell, you don't want destroyers, you want what we call a fleet unit, what I'm calling a fleet unit. And a fleet unit is a self-contained navy, a self-contained ocean-going effective navy. It's going to be based on a battle cruiser, some light cruisers, some destroyers, some submarines, some auxiliaries, and with that you can have your own navy for your nation. This is something that you can support, you can look after, and by the way, we'll have a couple of more of these fleet units around the Pacific, and they'll all join together and become the Imperial Pacific Fleet. Mm. So that's what comes out of the 1909 conference, and Australia signs up to that. It says, yes, we're happy, we will do that, and we start putting all our money into building ships. Now, the importance about the 4th of October 1913 is this is when those ships, the initial tranche of ships, had been built and had made the journey from various places, mostly the UK, and it came into Sydney Harbour to show off to the Australian nation, Australian people, what they'd bought. So really important as part of this glorious days of 1913. Mm. And that's why on the 4th of October this year there's going to be an international fleet review and a reenactment of this day. So if you're in Sydney, watch out for that. So this shows you that arrival of the fleet unit on the 4th of October. It's actually the second and third ships of the line. The first one was the battlecruiser Australia, which we'll see in a minute. Mm-hmm. And this is Sydney and Melbourne. And they were two modern light cruisers, which were basically the scouts for the fleet. If you can think of the armoured cruiser being the citadel with the big guns steaming along somewhere, these were its scouts. They'd whiz out, find out where the enemy was, and come back and tell the battlecruiser where it would have to sail to sink something. So they're high speed, they're very modern, They'd been built in the one's been built in Scotland and both built in Scotland. Anyway,
whatever.
Anyway, they left. Melbourne came out first early in the year, and Sydney, which is the one on the right, came out with Australia, leaving in July 1913 from Portsmouth.
Which is why we've scheduled this talk for now.
So right now, Australia and Sydney are heading out of Portsmouth down towards Africa.
Yeah.
So this is them there.
And now, they're followed by?
You can see the end of a cruiser there on the left. That's actually Encounter, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But as part of the fleet unit, there was, as I said, the battle cruiser, the light cruisers and the destroyers. Now, these destroyers were the ones that Australia was going to get anyway. This is what we planned to get even before the 1909 conference. And the important thing about them was there was going to be six. The first two were built in the United Kingdom. The third was built, then deconstructed, then shipped out to Australia and built here. And why was that important? Because there's not much point having a navy if you don't have appropriate infrastructure to keep it going.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all about building up Australia as a nation, building up our industry, building up our skill sets so that we can be a modern nation. So these three destroyers, Yarra, Parramatta and Warrego, they were the tail end of the fleet unit coming in on the 7th. And I guess stop there and talk for a minute about the names of the ships. It's very interesting how they chose them. The flagship, the battlecruiser Australia, was named Australia. Why is that important? Because the Navy was the first national institution of importance. Remember, we're talking about colonies that had all been separate beforehand. Colonies that hated each other, that couldn't even agree on the same rail gauge, that were all competing. It was very important for the federal government to develop a sense of Australian nationhood. How better to do that than naming the flagship of the Navy Australia? Now, how do you satisfy states' interests? You name the cruisers after the capitals of the states, which is why you have Sydney and Melbourne. And the one that was going to be built afterwards was Brisbane, and the one after that was Adelaide. The destroyers, same idea, but let's call them after rivers from each of the states, which is why you get Parramatta, Warrego and Yarra, and the other ones ended up as Huon, Swan and Torrens.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all reasons why these things are happening. Right, this is actually just after the fleets come in and they're moored in Sydney Harbour, and obviously the big vessel there is HMAS Australia, which is a battle cruiser of the dreadnought type. And it's really important when you think about a ship like this, and if you've been to the 1913 exhibition, which I encourage you all to if you haven't, there's a model of Australia there, and you get an impression of what it's got in it and how powerful it was. When you think that at this period of history, the dreadnoughts were the strategic currency of the day. You know, these days we talk about ICBMs and something like that, or aircraft carriers perhaps. In 1913, you were talking about dreadnought-type ships. How many dreadnought ships have you got? Well, Australia had one. And that's really important because it meant that Australia felt that it had a voice on the world stage. Once Australia has a navy with a flagship like that, Australia is saying we can enforce the policing of the Pacific. We don't need the Royal Navy anymore. We can do it by ourselves.
And can I just draw attention to the number of people? There's just the snapping of the crowd down the bottom there. But this was a gala event, and tens of thousands of Sydneysiders came to gawk at their new ships. And it's a sign, as we saw from Zora Smith, just how much of an impact the arrival of the fleet made on Australians. There you go. There's...
Can we just go back to that one?
Yeah, then? Sure.
Just... Ooh. I'll point out you have Australia, but you have the three cruisers, in fact, just mm-hmm. to the right, and Fort Denison there. And there's quite a few the paintings that have been done of the event. And you really have to, if you read the newspaper accounts of the time about how important this was, they talk about it as if it was the most important thing since Captain Cook's arrival.
Mm. And just to orient you, if you were... standing in the Botanic Gardens, the Opera House is on your left, so you can see the same spot today, to no purpose.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Now, this is That's Encounter, which is one of the other cruisers. There was the Sydney, the Melbourne, and the Encounter that came in on October 1913. A Counter wasn't a modern cruiser. She was about 10 years old, and she was actually one of the ships from the Australian squadron that the Royal Navy had. And what, because we were still building our ships, Brisbane, which was going to be the next one, was being built at Cockatoo Island in Sydney. Until she'd been completed, the Royal Navy loaned the Encounter to the Royal Australian Navy, and which is fine. She was still very useful, particularly during the early months of the First World War. So she's slightly older design than the Sydney and the Melbourne.
Some of the sailors.
The people.
Yeah. Would you like to talk about who these guys are?
Talk about the people.
Yeah.
One of the things you have to understand about Australia in 1913 is it's very hard to say who was an Australian. Because what criteria do you use? Is it the fact you've been born here? Is it the fact that you've emigrated here? Is it the fact that you've, you know, you lived here for a while?
Yeah,
these sort of issues. And it's you can't really put labels on it like perhaps we might do today. So when we talk about the people who manned the first fleet, they're from a whole range of different areas. Many of them were on loan from the Royal Navy, the reason being that in 1909 we'd had 240 people in our Navy. 240. That had to grow to over 3,000 by 1913. Now, the only way you could do that, train these people, is to loan them from the Royal Navy. So I think about, depending on which ship, we're talking about between 50 and 60% of the fleet were on loan from the Royal Navy. Many others, now, having said that, some of those people were actually Australian-born because they had gone to the Royal Navy either as part of the Australian squadron or they'd gone back to the UK. So, again, you've got to be a little bit careful. One of the reasons they'd volunteered to come to the Australian Navy is because they were Australian, even though they were actually serving in the Royal Navy.
Okay.
We had to set up this infrastructure to train people, to get them ready. And fortunately, because we had this the core experience from the Royal Navy, it was actually not too difficult.
Okay.
And this gets back to our picture of why we were trying to do this. This is the launch of Warrego, which is the third destroyer that came in 1913, and the one that had been constructed in Scotland, deconstructed, brought out to Australia and constructed again at Cockatoo Island. And it really was a matter of, you know, when they were looking at what the Navy was doing, our politicians weren't saying this is money down the drain. What they were saying is this is money for an investment, and not only for defence, but also for our infrastructure, our industry, to get Australia moving as a modern nation.
Yeah. Oh, that's just a couple of destroyers.
Yeah,
that's
the interesting thing about this is it gets back to what the Australian Navy was trying to do, or what the government was trying to do with the Navy. They were trying to bring together this national sentiment. They were trying to say, we are a nation now, we can do things as a nation, not just as separate states. And the way they did that was that they made sure that the Navy went off and visited every possible port they could. And this is Yarra
Hobart
and Parramatta in about 1911, visiting Coffs Harbour, which they went all the way up the Queensland coast, all the way down the Victorian coast. The interesting thing there is you'll notice that it's got the blue ensign on the stern rather than the white ensign. This is because when the Australian, in fact, it's got the Union Jack at the front. The reason for that is when we got the Royal Navy, we were the Commonwealth Naval Forces, and then we became the Royal Australian Navy in 1911, we changed the flags. Before we were the Royal Navy, the Admiralty had said, well, you can't fly out the white ensign because you're not part of the Imperial Navy, which is why they had the Australian blue ensign on the stern. Once we became the Royal Australian Navy, we could fly the white ensign at the stern.
Right. Coaling.
Coaling was no fun. One of the things when you have an idea of the Royal Navy, it was a very structured, very hierarchical, you know, the captain at the top's God, the officers are up there among the angels, and the lower deck isn't really much thought of at all. Well, the thing about coaling is that everybody got involved, and the crews loved it because it meant that everybody was working Everybody was dressed up. Everybody was dirty as the same. And it was a dirty job. I mean, I don't know anyone here has ever had to deal with coal, but if you can imagine a ship that relies on getting in 300 or 400 tons of this stuff if it goes out for a day, you have everybody dressed up in their worst outfits. You do this as soon as you get in. You don't get a rest. You get inside a harbour. The barge comes up. You put people in the barge. You load up the coal in sacks. You put it on the deck. You empty it out. You shovel it down into the bunkers. And perhaps the worst job was the people in the bunkers, because when you're pouring it down a hole, it all ends up right underneath the hole. So you have to have trimmers to move it to the edges of the bunker so you get maximum out in. And they're in an increasingly smaller spot as the coal rises. Now, the whole ship is covered in coal dust. You get very little water to wash yourself with afterwards. It is no fun at all. Mm. And that is why everybody really loved when we went to oil, because oil is wonderful.
Yeah. Okay. Ooh.
Here we're doing some gun drill in HMAS Sydney, and obviously Sydney became very famous for its engagement with Emden in 1914. And I think part of the interesting thing about this sort of training is that we were very lucky when we had the Navy in that we weren't starting from nothing. And when I said how important it was to have the core of the Royal Navy people, that is really, really important, because it meant that your people who are just coming on board with very little experience have got people who can teach them and teach them properly. And when you look at the results of the 1913 gunnery exercises, for example, Australian ships are right there at the top, i.e. we were as good as any comparable Royal Naval vessel. And that was really important as we moved into the First World War.
Mm. Now, I think we've got one more.
Yeah. That's Australia, which, as I said, you've got a model in in the exhibition. It's the flagship. It's called Australia. And it's a dreadnought, really important.
Indeed. Thank you. Now, I think
that's the end.
Yes, there's Zora Smith. It's my hero. So we'll leave her there for a minute. Take a seat again, David, because we'd like to have a little bit more chat before we open it up to the audience. Because having got this wonderful new fleet unit, what happens to it? And clearly the First World War happens to it. So would you like to talk about what happened to the Royal Australian Navy in the 5 years following 1913?
How long?
Well, I can see your point. Well, put it this way. Let me focus my question then. What do you think were these ships the best that could be had, and did Australia make the best use of them?
They were the best that could be had, and we did as best as we could with them, yes. Mm-hmm. I guess the most important thing, I mentioned before about the Germans and all the other threats. Well, the Germans were the big threat, obviously, and that's where the war came from. In 1914, the Germans had a squadron of ships in East Asia under Vice Admiral Maximilian Graf von Spee, including two armoured cruisers, Scharnhorst and Gneisenau. Now, they weren't as capable as Australia, but they were extremely capable by themselves, these ships. And plus, they had some light cruisers like Emden. Now, this force was based in China at Tsingtao, but also had bases in other areas, including New Guinea and Rabaul. So they were quite close to Australia, because German New Guinea was the top half of Papua there. And the orders for this squadron at the start of the war were to intercept Australian trade and to sink Australian ships and, as I said, if possible, bombard harbours, steal coal, all those sort of things. Because we had HMAS Australia, the Germans said, we're not going there. We're not going to do that. We're going to go somewhere else where Australia isn't. And that's really important, because it's a demonstration of the deterrent value of HMAS Australia. And when people talk about what the Navy did in World War One, they tend to get hung up on a sort of an idea that you have to fight, you have to blow things up. I mean, yes, that's part of it, but actually it's far better if you don't have to fight. And Australia worked in that way. It deterred the Germans from coming to Australia and attacking our ports or our trade. So all that money we spent on it was really worthwhile.
Mm.
But what did we do in the first few months? We went up to New Guinea and took over that from the Germans. We chased Admiral von Spee across the Pacific Ocean, where he was eventually sunk off the Falkland Islands. We operated off East Africa, trapping a German cruiser, Königsberg, in East Africa. We obviously destroyed the Emden, which was preying on trade in the Indian Ocean. And then our fleet really dispersed into ships that were staying in Australian area to protect Australia, and those that went to operate with the Royal Navy in the North Sea.
So, final question for us. Does that mean that the Navy worked in the way it was envisaged? That those who planned it and funded it and welcomed it saw it behave exactly as they'd expected?
It's not really... You can't really answer it in that yes or no fashion. There's too many shades of grey.
Yeah.
Because it depends which person you're talking about. The thing is that it is a very... The fleet was flexible enough that it could do lots of different jobs,
mm-hmm.
and it was called on to do those jobs.
Mm.
You never got the Pacific Imperial Fleet that they were talking about, but then you didn't need that because there wasn't a threat against a major power. It was Germany with one squadron.
Yeah.
So you didn't need to have to do that job. But you then... part of the idea behind making the Navy the way it was that it was going to be interchangeable with the Royal Navy, both in ships and people. And the fact that it went over to the North Sea and was interchangeable and did do that indicates it worked exactly as it was planned.
Mm, thank you. Now, there's a threat now. Thank you very much, David. But David's staying around because we're now opening the floor to the audience. So if you've got questions, now's your chance. And the threat is that if you don't ask questions, I'm going to declaim some more poetry by the wonderful Zora Smith. Now, it's great poetry, but you may not want to hear more of it. Before I invite people to contribute, can I inform you that this program's being recorded? That's why we're all mic'd up. And Luke and possibly Alex have microphones. And if you participate in the Q&A session, then we have gained your consent. So we don't worry about getting forms, but we have your consent to be recorded. So can I invite members of the audience to either ask a question, especially with David, as you see, the expert on the subject, or make a contribution. There's a gentleman at the back.
When did the fleet get radio communications?
I'll repeat the question while the microphone's on the way. When did the fleet get radio communications?
The first experiments were about 1903 in Brisbane with a ship called Guyanda, part of the Queensland branch of the Navy at that stage. So they came out to Australia in 1913 with wireless communication. And one of the things the Navy did at the start of the war was take over all Australian wireless communication. So when you think about who was talking to who in 1914-18, it was being run by the Navy.
Mm. Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Yes, to the extent that the technology was good enough at that stage. I mean, you did have... I mean, there were... it was very atmospheric reliant, as it still is. You didn't have... you still had cables, remember, as well. It wasn't just all wireless. But they talk about... in fact, when Australia came out in 1913, they did wireless tests all across the Indian Ocean to determine when they lost contact with South Africa and when they gained contact with Fremantle. And so, yes, they did manage to get communication, but, you know, not every day, not every hour, but usually at night.
Mm. Thank you. And there's one down the front here, and then halfway up. Ooh, we've got a forest of hands. Right. Yeah.
Thank you. A comment first and then a question. You mentioned the Boxer Rebellion. As an undergraduate student in Adelaide some 50-plus years ago, we were told that New South Wales sent some aid, naval aid, to the Boxer Rebellion. And on the way, they fired the cannon just to get a bit of practice, and they lost so much way because of recoil that they got there after the Boxer Rebellion was over. The question is a bit more contemporary, all these coming forward a bit. Where was New Zealand in this great geostrategic pattern for this part
New Zealand, as I mentioned, had offered a dreadnought to the Royal Navy, and that became HMS New Zealand, which was a sister ship for Australia.
And there's a great model of it in the National Museum of New Zealand as well. So
So. I hope it looks the same as the one down there.
It looks smaller.
But the thing about New Zealand, though, was they did not expect it to... when they originally had funded it, they had visions of it being part of the fleet unit that was going to help protect New Zealand in the Pacific. Now, because of people like Churchill, who said, no, the threat is in the North Sea, we need everything we can possibly get in the North Sea, New Zealand remained in the North Sea during the war. It did make a visit to New Zealand before the war, and it did come out after the war with Admiral Jellicoe as part of a defence plan for a visit as well. But so from that extent, New Zealand, the HMS New Zealand didn't really do much for New Zealand's defence. But when the Australia station closed down under British control, they moved to New Zealand. So at the start of the war, there were several cruisers operating out of New Zealand, which were involved in escorting New Zealand troops to Samoa and to Western Australia so that they could then get in the Anzac convoys. So, yes, there were ships that were... And often they did have New Zealand people on those ships.
Mm, thank you. The gentleman in the orange chairs up there. Yeah.
Thank you. You mentioned earlier the relationships between the British Empire and the Japan. Would you like to touch on the role of the Imperial Japanese Navy working with the Australian Navy and its role in the area during the time of the First World War?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. There was always this love-hate relationship, obviously. And in fact, because we had sent our ships off all over the world on imperial missions, we ended up having to use Japanese ships to protect Australia when German raiders came out in 1917, which obviously put some people offside. But the Japanese made a great contribution to what was going on in the First World War at sea. Obviously, Ibuki, which was a Japanese armoured cruiser, was part of the first convoy that took the Anzacs from Albany off to the Middle East. And there's a model of Ibuki in the War Memorial, if you've ever been there. So there was this very close connection at that stage. The Japanese, when we were chasing the Von Spee across the Pacific Ocean, there were Japanese squadrons doing the same thing. HMAS Australia, our battlecruiser, operated with Japanese ships in that search off South America for Von Spee. The Japanese helped in the chasing down Emden. The Japanese operated in the Mediterranean during the First World War. So there was a lot going on with the Japanese. The interesting thing there is that when you read the reports from British officers about what the Japanese were doing, it's, yes, we've got the Japanese ship, whatever it happens to be, in Penang, and we've noticed that the guys are over the side doing soundings and investigating what the lay of the land is. And it gets back to my comment about the Americans in 1908. You know, navies are great for doing a lot of things, including intelligence gathering.
Mm, indeed, thank you. The gentleman just to your right.
Thank you. In the first decade after Federation, what were the command and control arrangements? For example, did the Australian Defence Minister or Naval Minister, if there was one, did they have any control over what happened in that first decade?
Certainly, when one of the things that they were trying to work out when the fleet unit was coming was how this was going to be used, what command and control arrangements were going to be in force. And what you see in the in that lead-up to the First World War is the arguments between those in Australia who are saying, this is how we're going to operate it, and the Imperial connection, which is saying, this is where those ships are going to be sent to. And so it never was properly sorted out before the war started, and what you end up with is both things happening. So, for example, HMAS Australia's war orders, what it was supposed to do when the war started, was to go to the China station and operate up there off in Hong Kong and Singapore, not defend Australian territory. But what the Australians had done had put a clause in the war orders that said if there was a threat to Australian territory, it could be retained to deal with that threat. And that is how they argued for Australia to stay at the start of the war to operate at Samoa and New Guinea, etc., because they said, well, there is a German threat, therefore we can't release it yet. And so there was a to-ing and fro-ing. But one part of the agreement that was when it was setting up the fleet unit was that in time of war, it would become part of an imperial fleet. Therefore, it would be run by the Admiralty. And very soon after the start of the war, that telegram was sent, which said, you know, the Royal Australian Navy is now part of the King's Naval Imperial Naval Forces. Mm. The slight caveat on that is the British weren't interested in the entire Australian fleet. They were only interested in the battle cruiser and the two light cruisers, Sydney and Melbourne. All the rest of the fleet, the Brits were quite happy for the Australians to keep running in the local area.
Mm. Thank you. So that tension between Britain and Australia that we see in the Second World War, it starts before and during the First World War. Great. Over here.
Following on from the previous question, the Navy Board, do we know when it was first convened, where it met, and when, and how it was composed? Were they predominantly British officers? Were there Australian officers? Were there politicians involved? And who did it report to? And who was it responsible to?
The Navy Board, Australian Commonwealth Naval Board, ACNB is the answer. And it started life when Creswell was made the Director of Naval Forces in 1904. And I think the first meeting of the Naval Board was 1905. And that was a temporary arrangement until we got to the Royal Australian Navy era when it became the Australian Commonwealth Naval Board. Now, it worked for the Australian government. It didn't work for the Admiralty. It always reported through the minister to the government. The minister, whether it was the defence minister or the naval minister, depending on whether we had a separate naval department or not, was the president of that board. The first naval member was Admiral Creswell. So he was an Australian in that respect. The second naval member, who was responsible for personnel, tended to be a British officer, a British captain, simply because there was more of them around. We had very few, you know, naval officers in who were Australian, had been come up through the Australian system. The third naval member was Admiral Clarkson, who was an engineer, and he was also an Australian. And then you had finance and civil members who was originally a Royal Naval officer, and then it became a civilian Australian from the Queensland Public Service. So it was mostly Australian officers, other than, I said, the second naval member tended to be a Royal Naval officer on exchange.
And there are two things you can look at here. Robert Hislop's Australian Naval Administration is a wonderful book for that, for dealing with that. But also, David's too modest to say, but his book on the history of the Royal Australian Navy goes into that too, that the whole governance of the RAN in that early period. So I can recommend it.
I don't know about the first meeting. I've got copies of the wartime minutes. There is no reason why they shouldn't exist.
Yeah, they should
probably
be
in archives.
National Archives in Melbourne, yeah.
But I've got to tell you, they're not very exciting.
They tend to be
one-liners on what was about.
In the middle. Hello. Wait for the microphone. Because it's all going on the website.
Was there any mutiny in the First World War on Navy ships?
That's a Dorothy Dixer, isn't it?
Thank you, Keith. There were a number of mutinies in the First World War. And there is this idea that Australians were particularly, you know, ill-disciplined and liked to fight and liked to drink and all that sort of thing. They weren't necessarily called mutinies. Sometimes they were called a stop work or a strike, or down tools or something, depending on, you know, what the circumstances were. A lot of it was to do, when you look at it, a lot of the disciplinary problems tended to be with the stokers, the guys who had to run the engines, who had to deal with that coal the whole time. Mm. Now, strange enough, They had a really bad life. They were working, you know, there was no air conditioning in these ships. You're operating in the tropics. You're working in these engine rooms with temperatures up to 100 and something. They would come off watch. They would, you know, they get into a harbour, they're coaling, there's no break for them, never get up, you know, they go for months without a full night's sleep because of the watchkeeping system. They are the ones who tended to be the one where the dysentery problem started. There were a few that happened throughout the war on various ships.
Mm. Did it create changes in the way things were managed?
To the extent that was one of the great reasons that the Navy moved to oil, even though it was more expensive, was because they wanted to get away. They knew that that's where the dysentery problems were going to come. It's very expensive to have all these people who just shovel coal. They tend to be the ones who are upset most of the time. Let's get rid of most of them by changing oil.
Thank you. All right, last question over there, and then we'll wrap up. Thank you.
At what stage, if ever, did we lose our fear of the US?
I'm not too sure if I can answer that.
You're a historian, not a futurologist, for one thing.
Some of us argue that we still have worries. I think in international relations, your interests are only as...
But it's a good question, though, because the question should be, I suggest, at what point did the US stop making plans to invade Australia? And I suppose the answer to that might be the late 30s.
Yeah, 1930s. Was, I don't know about the late, but yeah, certainly by the 1930s. Yeah. But I'll just give you an example of, 1908, Great White Fleet, lots of flags, everything's fantastic. 1915, 16, the Americans aren't in the war on our side. Therefore, they're not friends. Mm. And we, when we're operating on the China station with our destroyers, I won't go into the details, but we're actually doing a blockade of the Philippines, which was American territory. And you get interrelation, you know, not exactly a ding-dong, but American destroyers and Australian destroyers facing off against each other because the Australians are trying to intercept a ship and the Americans are saying, hang on, that's in our territorial waters, you can't do it. So, friends is a relative term.
Relative term, and it changes. I should explain, too, that the reason that David is able to respond to these questions with the assurance that he can is that he's just come back from spending, I think, a year in Britain, in which he had the enviable experience of sitting in the Royal Navy Historical Section's offices in Portsmouth, where, believe it or not, they delivered files to him from National Archives. So he's not just sort of making this up. You've actually read those files where the signals were exchanged from the ships and from the stations and so on. So we've really been privileged to obtain the benefit of David's massive expertise there, and I'll ask you to thank him in a minute. I'm going to do a couple of things before we finish. I'm really tempted to read out more of the wonderful poetry of Zora Smith, but only another two stanzas. You've got to stand up for poetry, you see. And it really underlines the point that David's made, that Australia's Navy grows out of and for a time is in friction with the Royal Navy. Now, in 1913, Zora Smith wrote that wonderful poem in which she celebrated our fleet. And this morning, only this morning, I discovered that she wrote another poem in 1914. After the Sydney Emden fight, she published verse in the Sydney Mail called To the Navy. And in a sense, it's a coda to her previous praise of this Navy that she thinks will do great things. Less than a year later, or just over a year later, it is doing, in her view, great things. So I'll read you two stanzas from her poem To the Navy. And there's more heave-hoing, I'm afraid. She loves heave-hoing. We've built us ships for the sea, boys, with a heave-ho, heave-ho, yo-ho. We've known the paths of the free, boys, since we were able to crow. Old England is rich in glory, boys, on the sea she has made her home. So let's continue the story, boys, of the victories of the foam. So you can see the pride that Australians had in the Navy. And thanks to David's expertise and the pictures he's explained to us, we can get a sense of why Australia had this very positive view of its first Navy. And you can see why the National Museum chose to make sure that its Glorious Days Australia 1913 exhibition made clear that the Navy was a part of 1913 for Australia. So now I have to thank various people. First of all, can I thank Alex and Luke and Ken in the box back there who've made it all work with our headphones and things and have structured the session. Thank you for your work behind the scenes. Thank you all
for coming and for contributing as you have. We're both conscious that there are people here in the audience who have a deep interest in the Navy. And speaking on behalf of the National Museum, even though I don't work here anymore, I can say that the museum is very pleased to have made sure that it's included the Navy in the exhibition. And I have to acknowledge the way in which the Navy assisted the National Museum in creating the exhibition. It was a very positive experience, and we're very glad we've had it. I don't know about you, but we're very glad we've had it. And finally, can I ask you to thank David for coming along and sharing his expertise with us? Thank you all very much. Okay. And I'm required to mention, too, that to please reiterate David's suggestion to go and see the exhibition. I think it'll cost you $10. And at the end of the exhibition, you, of course, exit through the gift shop. And in the gift shop, there's this wonderful book called Glorious Days, Australia 1913, edited by my former colleague, Michelle Hetherington, which is a very handsome evocation of Australia in 1913 and includes essays by various people on various aspects, including myself on the Navy. And I can thoroughly commend it to your attention. So thank you for coming to the National Museum today, and we bid you a good day. Thanks. Good day.
Thank you for that.
That's great. Yeah, that worked really well.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.